Thank you for venturing. Ooh, this is very, very loud. No, no, it isn't.
No, it isn't. Okay.
So it's not too loud. Okay. Anyway, welcome to Daring to Venture into the Deep and to these conversations that we've been having this second Saturday of the month. It's been Bill's and my pleasure, and hope it has been yours as well. I do want to mention today that there is a women's retreat a Trinity Church women's retreat. So a number of people who regularly attend with us are not here today. So the size of the group ebbs and flows, but I just wanted to mention that a number of people are at a retreat this weekend. Our topic today for conversation is worldview and beauty. Okay, and I will explore that in a moment. Let me make a couple of quick announcements, and then we'll get underway. On the back table as you go out, there is a sign-up if you would like to be on the email list for the Marcus J. Borg Foundation. Okay, so feel free to add your name to that if you would like. The Marcus J. Borg Foundation is sponsoring these conversations. Our primary mission is to help and encourage conversation, to help articulate a fresh and deeper and wider understanding of what it means to be Christian in the 21st century. Okay. And in addition to that, sort of what it means to be a more humane humanity. I am very grateful to Jed Holdorf and to Trinity for our ability to rent this space on the second Saturday for us to gather here. As I've said before, one of the things that I so appreciate about Trinity is that this is a place that you can have this kind of conversation. And whether you completely agree or not with what Bill and I say, we're really here for prompting and for encouraging conversation and dialogue. So I told Jed that I will always make a disclaimer that the opinions that are expressed here may or may not be the opinions of Trinity Episcopal Church. But it's just a real honor to be able to be in this space together. There is also, and I will say something about this at the end of our time this morning, there's also a handout that I would love for you to take with when you leave today. It is the announcement of an event that the Borg Foundation will be sponsoring in May. And I will say more about that at the end of our time. But please feel free to take one or two and share it, okay? But let me start by reading the Listening Hearts guidelines that we've been using to help create a kind of ethos amongst ourselves, a kind of way of listening and paying attention and creating space for others to speak. So, as has been my custom, let me read for us the listening guidelines. Take time to become settled in God's presence. Listen to others with your entire self, senses, feelings, intuition, imagination, rational faculties. Do not interrupt. Pause between speakers to absorb what has been said. Do not formulate what you want to say while someone else is speaking. Speak for yourself only, expressing your own thoughts and feelings, referring to your own experiences. Avoid being hypothetical and steer away from broad generalizations. Do not challenge what others say. Except Bill and I might be able to do that. Listen to the group as a whole, to those who have not spoken aloud as well as to those who have. Generally, leave space for anyone who may want to speak a first time before speaking a second time yourself. And the last one, hold your desires and opinions, even your convictions, lightly. As I have said before, I don't think these are easy to follow, but I think they're wonderful guidelines. According to the Christian tradition, and if you're following the narrative following the Christian narrative, we are in the season of Lent. And I'm going to say more about that in just a minute. And Lent, in the narrative, is the time when we journey with Jesus from Galilee to Jerusalem. And this is the Lenten journey is his last journey to Jerusalem, and he will meet his death. Okay. So the Lenten season is the season in the narrative where we travel the way with Jesus to Jerusalem. For those of you who were here last time, we talked a bit about the season of Epiphany, which in brief, I will suggest, is the season not only in the church here, but in our lives, when we see things the way they really are. We see things the way they really are. And you might remember last time I quoted from Thomas Merton, who had this experience on the corner of 4th and Walnut, and he saw you, if you will, and realized that, you know, you were all just shining like the sun, okay? And that is really the core reality of everyone, that they're shining like the sun. And he said, you know, you can't go around telling people that, but I wish they could see it and know it. And he said, you know, God is shining through everything all the time. And life is this simple, that God is shining through us all the time. But the problem is, we don't see it. So I suggest that the season of Epiphany is the time or these opportunities when we see something as it really is. And my premise, without rose-colored glasses, but my premise is that we really are lit from within. We're lit from within. And the last Sunday of the season of Epiphany, we always see we hear the Transfiguration story. It shows up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the tradition has us have that be the last story of the season of Epiphany every year. And that story of the Transfiguration, there's a lot to unpack there. I'm not going to do that today. But Jesus is seen sort of dazzling. And I would suggest that what we see is Jesus lit from within. And it's a precursor to what's going to happen at the resurrection. The Transfiguration happens on a mountaintop, and so does the resurrection on Mount Calvary. So the Lenten journey is framed by two stories about how we are lit from within. I just want to make a note of that. Let me say something else about Lent right now. Lent has traditionally been considered a penitential season, a time to confess your sins. And, you know, Shrove Tuesday is from an old English word, shriven, which means to confess. Okay. So, you know, we tend to think that Lent is this time in our lives where we say, the great microphone, right, the great microphone feedback. It's like, worm that I am, and, you know. And I don't know if the reason that the tradition tended to go that way is because of the conventional sense that Jesus died for our sins, and so we need to name those sins and, you know, get real with that, because that's all part of coming to, I don't know, be worthy enough to have accept Jesus as the one who died for our sins. That whole premise and the meaning of Jesus being that, I don't agree with, okay? But I don't know if that's why the season of Lent has so often been considered penitential. I don't think it is. I suggest that the season of Lent, and let me say, as I did last time, that not only is this a season in the liturgical year, in the worship year of the church, But I suggest, and this is one of the things I love about the Christian tradition, is that these seasons are reflective of seasons in our lives. That some of the moods and characteristics and themes of the liturgical seasons actually are seasons in our own human experience. And those seasons can be really helpful in terms of shining a light, if you will, or focusing our attention on some things that we as human beings go through. Okay? So the season of Lent, I suggest, is not a penitential season. Because of the narrative in the Christian tradition and Jesus coming to terms with his own death, I do suggest that the season of Lent, when it happens to us, is a time in our lives when we come to face the fact and truth of our mortality. And actually get real about that, okay? And I suggest that what the season of Lent is about, it is a time in our lives, probably most often precipitated by a crisis or something outside of ourselves, when the question is called. Lent, I suggest, is the time when the question is called on what we believe, why we believe it, what we think is important, what we value, what, to borrow from Mary Oliver, we want to do with our one wild and precious life, and how we want to go about doing that. Okay? It's one thing for me to say, gee, I wonder what I'm going to be when I grow up. It's another to have something happen in my life that it's one thing for me to ask the question, what do I think is important? It's another when something happens in your life that actually calls the question to you. So now what do you think? So now what do you think is real? So now what do you think is possible? So now what are you basing your assumptions about reality about? So now how are you going to organize your life in light of this? And I suggest that most often, when the question is called at this level, it is a time when our mortality also, I don't want to say just looms large, but that we recognize the fact that, yes, we are mortal. And our mortal flesh, I would say, is lit from within, but it is indeed mortal flesh. So I think that death calls the question. And there are many who say that death is the great teacher. I think that's correct. I don't think we should look at death as necessarily the enemy. There are contexts for this, okay? But I suggest that death can be a great teacher because it calls the question on how we live, why we do, what we think is important. And now what are we going to do? I would also suggest that when something happens that calls the question, that it may change issues for you. I will, actually, this is personal, I will share this. After Mark died, for me, the question was called on all kinds of things. And one of the things that was called for me was, what do I think about life after death? I will tell you now that, you know, I don't know, okay? But for me, that is no longer my question. I'm not worried about that. For myself, for Mark, for you, I think that I've just sort of always assumed, of course there's life after death. Of course. There might be. But there was something about Mark's death that kind of shattered the question for me. Because I realized I don't know. And I shared with you a couple times ago that, you know, I before Mark died, I said, honey, if you could show, you know, be in touch, be in touch. And he kind of looked at me like, what are you thinking? You know, it's, as I shared with you a couple months ago, it is as though Mark has said to me, as Jesus said to his disciples, how long have I been with you? And you're still asking these questions, you know? So it's not a denial. It's not a denial about life after death. But I just will share with you, that's no longer one of my questions. Isn't that paradoxical? You'd think that now it mattered more than ever. In some ways it does, but it's not my question anymore. I trust in the buoyancy of God more deeply than I ever have. Okay. So I think that the season of Epiphany, okay, when we see things as they really are, is a wonderful preparation for the season of Lent, when the question is called on what we think is real and possible. The season of Epiphany gives us glimpses. And then the season of Lent calls the question on the integrity of that and challenges us to grapple with the reality in which we live and move and have our being. Okay? So, I'm going to read something from, it's from the Chronicles of Reuben, R-U-B-E-M, and his last name is A-L-V-E-S. He's Brazilian. How do you pronounce A-L-V-E-S?
In Brazil?
In Elvis? Alvis, not Elvis. Alvis, is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Alvis Crosley.
Okay, so Reuben Alvis, okay? He died several years ago. I think he's brilliant. But this is a story that he shares in a little book called The Best Chronicles of Reuben Alvis. But last week, something strange happened. I picked up an onion, like all the others, cut a ring as I always did, and was surprised. I sensed that I had never seen an onion. Was that possible? I've seen and cut hundreds of onions. And now it's as if I were seeing the onion for the first time. I looked at the rounded shape, felt the smoothness of its skin under my fingers, saw the rings, circular, perfect, one tucked into the next. The light fragmented in hundreds of shining points on its surface. My practical, unconscious thought was interrupted. I left the knife on the sink and was spellbound with the onion ring in my hand. I forgot about the dish I was preparing. At that moment, I didn't want to make any dish whatsoever for the delight of my mouth, because I had encountered another form of delight, the delight of my eyes. My eyes were eating the onion ring, and I sensed a pleasure I had never sensed. For the first time in my life, I saw that the onion is beautiful. If I were a painter, I would paint an onion. If I were a photographer, I would photograph an onion. My onion had left behind being just a creature from the produce section of the supermarket, at the mercy of knives and chewing jaws. And it seemed like, let me just read that again. My onion had left behind being just a creature from the produce section of the supermarket, at the mercy of knives and chewing jaws. And it seemed like an enchanted creature, resident of the world of beauty, beside jewels and works of art. When I awoke from the mystic trance, where I saw an onion ring as if it were a stained glass window in a Gothic cathedral, I became frightened. What strange thing must have happened to my eyes? What strange transformation must have been happening to me? If I told my friends what had happened, they would not understand. They would think I was kidding. They would laugh. I had to remain silent about my experience. Then I thought I was going crazy, because craziness must be this, that which you experience and have to keep quiet about. Because if you talk about it, others will not understand and will start to think that you've got a screw loose. But the worst is that what happened with the onion began to happen with everything. My eyes were no longer the same. They were possessed of a new psychedelic power. They saw what they'd always seen in a way they'd never seen. My paintings became different. My things became different. My plants became different. And most disturbing was the silly happiness that I sensed in everything. And I thought, if I keep feeling happy like this, all of my big plans will fall to the ground. If I feel joy at the smallest things, I'll stop struggling to accomplish big things. Let me say, beauty can be found within reach. And I suggest that beauty resides in the eye. And that it is it's woven into an essential part of our identity as human beings. So I suggest that beauty is something that we innately have the capacity to recognize, and that when we recognize it, then we see it everywhere. It's like Mary Oliver talking about the snow geese. And when I saw them, I saw them. Okay. When you see the onion, you really see the onion as it really is, I suggest. Okay? So, even though beauty may seem elusive, and we know two people may see it quite the same way, but I suggest that it is integral to being human. So, with that in mind, let me move a little bit to the notion of world view. World views, I suggest, are the way that we perceive reality, make sense and meaning of it. And by the way, religions, and we've talked about this before, I think in some ways that religions are developed as a means for human beings to cope with mortality. I think that's part of the function of religion, is that it helps us cope with the reality of our mortality. I think worldviews do the same. Or, let me put it this way, or worldviews get very involved in the denial of mortality. But we can wonder about that. Worldviews are ways of how we see the world. and then how we understand our own sense of meaning and participation in the world. Worldviews are, some of it is individual. I think that we all have a kind of worldview, whether or not we're really conscious of it or not. I think we all live out of a story, whether we're really conscious of it or not. I think so much of a collective worldview is so acculturated that we've internalized it without really challenging it or questioning it. So I think worldviews can be individual. I think they're also collective. I think societies and cultures have different ways of seeing all this and interpreting this. And I think also that a clash of worldviews cannot always be sorted out with fact-checking. Because I think that worldviews, I think we need to bring mind and heart to this. What we think is important, but I also think what we love and what we feel is important. So it's tricky with worldviews because I think it's hard for people who are enmeshed in a particular worldview to be convinced that it might be otherwise. Okay. I have my own bias about worldviews is that they should help us increase our commitment to serve the world. That a worldview should increase our commitment, our desire to serve the world, and as need be, to save it. Okay. So, let me just summarize, that I think that seeing things as they really are, the season of Epiphany, is a wonderful preparation for the season of Lent, which calls the question on what we really think is real and possible in light of our mortality. In light of our mortality. Fair enough that the season of Lent can also be in light of a great loss, which could be a divorce or a loss of a job or a loss of a worldview. But it's a kind of loss that also puts us in touch with our limits. So I think the question that gets called in this season is has ultimate consequences. Okay. And I suggest that the season of Lent is not penitential. It is not a time for us to overly apologize for how we have missed the mark, but rather a time when we are called to reevaluate what we think is important and make a difference. Do something, rather than apologizing for not having done something. I think death calls that kind of, the calling of the question from death can have that kind of urgency. But there are also times when the question is called and we will turn away from it. That reminds me of I do want to include this. This is from a poem of Denise Levertov's where she's describing Mary, okay, the angel appearing to Mary and basically saying, where Mary basically says, well, be it unto me according to your word. So this is like a kind of annunciation, a kind of calling the question to Mary. And the poem goes like this. She was free, I'm just reading a very small part of it. She was free to accept or refuse the call. Choice, integral to humanness. So I suggest that in the season of Lent, we have the freedom, if you will, to accept or refuse to engage in the question that's being called. And I think choice, as Denise Levertov puts so succinctly, is integral to humanness. We have the capacity to choose life or death, if you will. We have a capacity to choose whom or what we shall serve and how. Okay? So our will is really important when the question is called. But as Levertov says, we're free to refuse or accept. Aren't there annunciations of one sort or another in most lives? I would say in all lives. Some unwillingly undertake great destinies. More often, those moments when roads of light and storm open from darkness in a man or a woman. More often, those moments when roads of light and storm open from darkness in a man or a woman are turned away from. In dread, in a wave of weakness, in despair, with relief, ordinary lives continue. God does not smite them, but the gates close, the pathway vanishes. Now, I would suggest that there will be other gates and other paths. So I don't think that the question is called just once in our lives. I think it's called many times, and different circumstances and different life stages will evoke from us different levels of response. So as Levertov insists, God won't smite you if you say, let this cup pass from me. But that gate will close and that pathway will vanish. So I encourage you, when you are in the season of Lent and the question is called, respond to it. There's a good chance you'll have another time to respond to the importance of the question being called. We'll be given, I think, a number of opportunities before our final death. But may you respond to the call before your final death. Is someone going to answer?
Did you stage that? Who's the shill out there who That was perfect.
Thank you. So, I'm going to give us a minute to just sit with all of this, and I have this darling little 1 minute timer. And then at the end of that minute, I'll ring the bell. But let me give you just a couple of prompts. You know, what do you make of my, and by the way, I think worldviews are really, really important. Because I think, as I said earlier, whether we are conscious of it or not, we live out of a worldview. We live out of a story. And a lot of those stories we've just accepted as a given. Okay? And it might be, you know, might be pretty accurate. It may not be. It may be the tool of a collective mindset that has its own agenda. Okay? I mean, worldviews are very functional, and they can also, in the wrong hands, be used very oppressively. Okay. So what do you make of worldviews? What do you make of my suggestion that Lent is actually not a penitential season, but a season when the question is called? Have you experienced a time in your life when the question has been called? And how did that shift things for you? And beauty. What do you think of my thought that beauty is something that we all, that is woven integrally into what it means to be a human being, that we all have that Beauty lures us, it attracts us, it, if you will, calls to us. And I think that that is an innate longing and movement in being a human being. So I think the capacity for us to see beauty, whether it's in an onion, or whether it's in a sunset, or whether it's on the corner of 4th and Walnut, is part of who we are. And as a result, I think for us not to consider and reflect on what is beauty in light of constructing a worldview is a terrible omission. Okay. So, you know, what do you make of all of this? Okay. So I'm going to give us a minute. I'll ring the bell. And then, as is our custom, we'll just offer thoughts and reflections as we wish into our place here, our space here.
Just a moment, I'll bring a microphone.
I call the question on individuality and individualism. When you say we each have an individual world view, I hiccup. So let me try to unpack that. When you have a tree where every single leaf is unique, it has individuality, but that individuality dies if it disconnects from the whole. So this question of individuality and universals is the Western nut that we all struggle with, whether we know it or not. And it has given birth to duality and dualism, which are both two different things, right? Just like individuality and individualism is a belief in the individual. That the leaf can survive, indeed does survive, apart from the whole. Okay. So therefore, what is beautiful to me is an orchestra. And then on the personal level, it's singing, because singing, when a human sings, they're using their body, their vocal cords as an instrument. And dancing, there's different kinds of dancing. There's the twirling of the dervish, which they experience as spiritual. And there's the line dancing, which is so American. And then there's the kind of dancing that we can watch on a stage like a ballet, where is a wholeness of many people. The other thing is eating. And sharing that meal is a whole thing. It's not just individuals stuffing themselves to feel satisfied. Mm-hmm. But the sharing of a meal is, especially when it's exquisite, and you can look at each other like on Babette's feast.
Right.
And then when I worked at Barnes & Noble, on a bad day, they still made $15,000 selling books. And I thought to myself, we are so saturated with bad news because only bad news makes the news. And that it's and when I look at my library at the prison up in Madras, I've got 2,000 books there, and each one of them must have taken an author at least a year. So my little library of 2,000 books represents 2,000 years of humans' lives trying to say something to us. So those things are what I find beautiful. Oh. And thank you.
And just to mirror back a little bit, one of the things I love about what you're saying is that there, everything you described has a relational quality, okay? So I love that as something to identify in terms of our experience of beauty. It's relational. So.
As a fellow Episcopalian, how did you handle on Ash Wednesday the penitential prayer?
I'll give you an out. This wasn't really a Q&A session. It's just a reflection, so we can just leave the question sitting there.
That's true. Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I will, in just a moment, defer to my colleague, the very reverend.
The very reverend.
The very reverend Bill Ellis. You know, I think that the, yes, the liturgy and the language of penitential, and I think what the prompt is for all of that is a realization of our mortality. And to take our limit seriously. And I will have Bill do a nice apologetic, but I mean, I love the tradition. I love the tradition. I actually love the language of the tradition. I wear it proudly and without constriction.
Marianne and I are almost exact opposites on this. The language of the Ash Wednesday liturgy, which I just experienced again on Wednesday, I don't like terribly well, but I very much think that there is a penitential aspect to Lent. And it emerges, though, from exactly the sort of thing that Marianne is talking about. You're taking that journey, you're coming to grips with your own mortality. But part of coming to grips with your own mortality is coming to grips with the fullness of what you are and have been and what you can be. And that includes looking right into the beauty, right into the loveliness and the wonder of what it means to be a human being. But also it means coming to grips with what I'm capable of, which is also dark and terrible. To embrace the fullness of my humanity is to embrace all of that. And to realize that I am loved, that God is open to me, not just because of the wonder, but also because of the limitation, the short-sightedness, the narrowness, the self-interest, and so forth. And so that's where I get onto the penitential boat for Lent, because all of us are this remarkable mixture. I would also say that from the point of view of history, Marianne is absolutely correct about the original purpose of Lent. The original purpose of Lent long before the institution became important and powerful, and people began to be excommunicated because they thought and did the wrong things. Lent was a season of preparation for baptism. Mm-hmm. That's what Lent was primarily for. You baptize people at the vigil of Easter. It wasn't about the very first Jews who believed Jesus was the Messiah had no thought of penitence for Lent. It was a season of preparation. And then you're baptized. As the church became institutionalized, as it became more powerful, as the church began to get suspicious about some people, and indeed, as some people led notorious lives that were unworthy, really, of their calling, they began to boot people out. And Lent became a moment, as our invitation to Lent, when those people who, quote, because of notorious sins, had been excluded from the body of the faithful, were given an opportunity to repent and return to the fold. That is something that came later. And of course, ultimately overwhelmed the first and original purpose of Lent. So Marianne is absolutely right about what Lent was about to begin with. But that penitential notion worked its way in and overwhelmed the other over a period of time. But I still buy it from the point of view of, I need to know who I am, and that includes what I would call the good as well as the bad.
What you call what?
The good as well as the bad.
The good as well as the bad.
And the ugly.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah. Speaking of, a man's got to know his limitations.
And Bill will speak to this in the second half of our morning, but I also, using this about baptism, that actually in baptism, you're being immersed in a worldview.
You are. And that worldview is described by baptized into the death of Christ.
Yeah. And then how we have articulated that. Bill will speak more to that. But anyway, so in a sense, it's, I think it's congruent mm-hmm. with what I'm suggesting.
So lovely that you're here, and thank you for this gathering. Firstly, and simply, shortly, about worldview, one of my unwritten essays rolling around my head is called Sympathy for the Racists. And it basically, or the white supremacist, however we want to look at it. And the kernel of that thought developing is that for somebody to let go of a worldview that I personally find, and I think many people of goodwill would find abhorrent, takes a certain type of reflection and, in your words, maybe the calling of a question to see what has left somebody bankrupt or bereft of compassion or goodness. And having done a certain type of ideological shift myself, I know it's terrifying to let go of a way of being in the world, of identifying myself, of identity with group. And so worldview, while I think it's absolutely useful for us to examine what ours are. For there to be change in our society, I think we have to be compassionate for when people's worlds cave in, say, you know, as that happens. So I think, yeah. New paragraph. I'm really grateful for the framework that you give of Lent. As a Unitarian Universalist, I practice Lent. And I've been looking at it as a time for concentrated reflection. And interestingly, last year, I entered my seventh decade. I'm 61. And as you talk about the calling of the question of mortality, I'm feeling, even at 61, is pressing, is really pressing. It's like, Chela, stop ditzing around. Because there are several things that I feel are a call that I'm refusing and have just by my patterns of laziness or fear or whatever. And to wit, I think it was Thursday morning. I woke up with this horrible bad dream. I felt so bad in it, and I just forced myself not to remember it. I think it was a big drama dream, and I was feeling so bad in it, I just refused to take its medicine. And then last night, there was an artist reception I was attending. I was talking with some friends, and in this time of like heightened self-reflection, I was just feeling the edge around me really, disturbed somehow, disturbance in the force. And I had the thought as I got home, okay, just go and open your journal and just, will you write? And I didn't. So by saying these, by this sort of public confession, you know, may I redouble my efforts to look and to be seen and to really enter into this time. But I am very grateful for your framing of that.
And as I said earlier, trust in the buoyancy of God. Trust in the buoyancy of God. You will not plummet.
Just say walking around is part of giving space between comments. That's why time sometimes.
Thank you, Jed.
Just very quickly, I'm an artist, and my window is my portal is in to God is really through my art. And once you step into that world of color and shapes and texture and light, you never want to go back. And the onion, I've painted many because I illustrated family cookbooks and taught people how to write and illustrate their own family cookbooks. And so I'm very intimate with onions. And going into a produce store, for me, any kind of produce display is probably one of the most exhilarating experiences because you have everything. You have color, you have shape. And just looking at the two of you, you're opposites on the color wheel. So you're resonating with each other. So this is the world that I live in. It's really lovely to have that connection to God through God's design.
Great.
Do we have time for one more?
Yes.
My personal experience is needing the eyes to see, to recognize the call. Looking back on my life, I think there were lots of calls that I did not recognize.
Yeah.
And even the ones that I did recognize, I didn't recognize that's what it was at the time. It's only by looking back that I realized that I had responded to the call. And so my prayer is eyes to see. Because in my 77 years, I feel like I just stumbled through this life with blinders on. And there isn't much more time to see. And then the other thing is not feeling like I have what it takes to respond to the call anymore at this age.
Peggy, is my microphone on? That,
it is.
You have reminded me, called to mind one of my favorite stories from one of my favorite books. The greatest detective fiction ever written was by Fyodor Dostoevsky, called The Brothers Karamazov. It's the greatest whodunit I've ever read. He digresses periodically, and there's a story in there about the child who's going to die.
His parents are all grief-stricken, and they're trying to comfort him. And he ends up comforting them. He's a little child, and he says, a single moment is enough time to experience the fullness of what it means to be a human being. So it doesn't matter how long you live. All you need is that one moment, which he averred that he had had. So his life was complete, and his parents were able to then rest more easily. And it was a redemptive moment for everybody. And this is just a story that Dostoevsky periodically digresses into, but that has stayed with me forever precisely because of what you just said. For I, too, have just messed around and dithered and said no when I ought to have said yes, and said yes when I ought to have said no. And I wonder, have I had that moment yet? And I remain optimistic that I will, because all I need is one moment. And that's why and how that story has stayed with me, because it's really a beacon of hope in my whole life. And I just offer it to you as a possibility for you to ponder as well, courtesy of Dostoevsky.
Let's just sit with that for a moment. Let's let that be our thought as we go into our break.